I got invited to an exclusive resort to deliver a talk about the digital future to what I assume would be a couple of hundred tech executives. And I was there in the green room waiting to go on, and instead of bringing me to the stage, they brought five men into the green room who sat around this little table with me. They were tech billionaires. And they started peppering me with these really binary questions, like Bitcoin or Ethereum? Virtual reality or augmented reality? I don't know if they were taking bets or what. And as they got more comfortable with me, they edged towards their real question of concern. Alaska or New Zealand? That's right. These tech billionaires were asking a media theorist for advice on where to put their doomsday bunkers. We spent the rest of the hour on the single question, how do I maintain control of my security staff after the event? By the event, they mean the thermonuclear war or climate catastrophe or social unrest that ends the world as we know it and, more importantly, makes their money obsolete. And I couldn't help but think these are the wealthiest, most powerful men in the world, yet they see themselves as utterly powerless to influence the future. The best they can do is hang on for the inevitable catastrophe and then use their technology and money to get away from the rest of us. And these are the winners of the digital economy. The digital renaissance was about the unbridled potential of the collective human imagination. It spanned everything from chaos math and quantum physics to fantasy role-playing and the Gaia hypothesis. Right? We believed that human beings connected could create any future we could imagine. And then came the dot-com boom. And the digital future became stock futures. And we used all that energy of the digital age to pump steroids into the already dying NASDAQ stock exchange. The tech magazines told us a tsunami was coming, and only the investors who hired the best scenario planners and futurists would be able to survive the wave. And so the future changed from this thing we create together in the present to something we bet on in some kind of a zero-sum, winner-takes-all competition. And when things get that competitive about the future, humans are no longer valued for our creativity. No, now we're just valued for our data, because they can use the data to make predictions. Creativity, if anything, that creates noise. That makes it harder to predict. So we ended up with a digital landscape that really repressed creativity, repressed novelty, it repressed what makes us most human. We ended up with social media. Does social media really connect people in new, interesting ways? No, social media is about using our data to predict our future behavior, or when necessary, to influence our future behavior so that we act more in accordance with our statistical profiles. The digital economy, does it like people? No, if you have a business plan, what are you supposed to do? Get rid of all the people. Human beings, they want healthcare, they want money, they want meaning. You can't scale with people.
Kids learn how to use popular spreadsheet, word processing, and browsing software so that they can operate effectively in the high-tech workplace. These basic skills may make them more employable for the entry-level cubicle jobs of today, but they will not help them adapt to the technologies of tomorrow. Their bigger problem is that their entire orientation to computing will be from the perspective of users. When a kid is taught a piece of software as a subject, she'll tend to think of it like any other thing she has to learn. Success means learning how to behave in the way the program needs her to. Digital technology becomes the immutable thing, while the student is the movable part, conforming to the needs of the program in order to get a good grade on the test.
That as we destabilize and denaturalize the GUI as our default computational aesthetic and interface, we need to find new locations to resist, question, critique, and reconfigure our restricted possibilities of what computation can do, and that there are three quick ways of doing it. The first approach is to locate the bodies that are being invoked, subsumed, hidden, and interpolated in the technosocial condition. that every time you are faced with the idea of an interface, stop right there, stop thinking about the machine, and start thinking about the people who are being made invisible in the transparency of the GUI that is being presented to you. The second approach is to locate the internet in feedback loops, which are both graphically and structurally inherent to the orders of cybernetics that govern the systems of computation. So recognizing the feedback loop not as merely a natural default, but as a series of programming which is making you shape your behavior in a particular way is absolutely important in order to look beyond GIGO and WYSIWYG as the accepted naturality of computation. And the third approach is to complicate the attributes that we assign to human and technological actors in our complex technosocial engagements. That instead of trying to think about how the neurotic human is going to be rehabilitated and shaped so that it becomes an ideal human being, this is more or less what the Hong Kong government is doing to the protesters on the streets right now, trying to identify them as deviant, as neurotic, as irrational, and how we are going to bring them back into conversation and tame, shame, and frame them so that they become a part of rationality that we need our computation to establish for us, and that is necessary to keep on negotiating between the two. That we need to understand the interface not as a neutral site, but as an active force, not a noun, but a verb, which enables a mapping and critique of the forces that activate a particular moment of encounter, and that questions the obviousness of the GUI as a natural space.
We cannot truly communicate because we have no idea how the media we are using bias the messages we are sending and receiving. Our senses and our thoughts are already clouded by our own misperceptions, prejudices, and confusion. Our digital tools add yet another layer of bias on top of that. But if we don't know what their intended and accidental biases are, we don't stand a chance of becoming coherent participants in the digital age. Programming is the sweet spot, the high leverage point in a digital society. If we don't learn to program, we risk being programmed ourselves.
Technology and human rights sort of together as a sort of continuum, and technology actually as an enabling condition for things like human rights, not as the thing that humans actually need to have their rights. But this has become very muddied and confused now because our notion of speaking and freedom of speech and expression is very connected to technology now. We can't imagine being able to articulate and having freedom of expression without social media platforms, for example. It's almost like we don't know how to do that anymore. And it's interesting to remember that actually things like freedom of speech and expression were instituted to prevent the state control of individual voices. And I think we really need to pull apart this notion when we're thinking about many different kinds of non-state actors as well that are impinging on freedoms of expression. It's not always only top down. So for a long time, my work was about kind of the digital and the human together. And of late, I've been looking a lot at this question of data and discrimination and the idea that the word discrimination can mean to see very clearly, but it can also mean to bias in different ways, and how big data technologies eventually just work really perfectly in hierarchical societies, because how big data works is you have very large data sets, you have algorithms that find fairly arbitrary connections between data points in that set and then deliver those correlations as some kind of truth about things. And in this case, I want to talk about the Aadhaar project in India and caste and biometrics and what does it mean to have big data technologies in a society that's already very hierarchical and violently hierarchical.
As we lose the ability to program the world's computers, we lose the world's computing business as well. This may not be a big deal to high-tech conglomerates, who can as easily source their programming from New Delhi as New Hampshire, but it should be a big deal to us. Instead, we see actual coding as some boring chore, a working-class skill like bricklaying, which may as well be outsourced to some poor nation while our kids play and even design video games. We look at developing the plots and characters for a game as the interesting part, and the programming as the rote task better offloaded to people somewhere else. We lose sight of the fact that the programming, the code itself, is the place from which the most significant innovations emerge.
It's red in those wings at on, it's time, it's almost sinking. It's red in those wings at on,
respond to the contribution with one-liner thoughts, quotes or sentiments, it is important you do this while the contribution is playing. Reality is getting comfortable. A single question most powerful people see themselves as utterly powerless. Makes their money obsolete powerful, but powerless. Why are we trusting other people that don't share our interest? Collective human imagination, any future we could imagine, stock future pumping steroids futurists, and so. The dot-com boom, we don't control our future anymore, just data tech together in the present for who? For who? Now we're just valued for our data predictions. Creativity creates noise, repressed novelty predict future. Whose creativity, whose future repressing what makes us? Did social media connect people? Whose profiles, whose data predict our future behavior? Our kids will know how to behave well with technology, but not to critic it. Behaving well is success. We want an ideal human being, not irrational. We need to understand the interface and question it. Clouded in our own misreception, no freedom of expression if we don't have social media.
A couple of hundred tech executives. And I was there in the green.
To resist, question, critique, and reconnect.
Programming from New Delhi as New Hampshire. But it should.
It's an enabling condition for things like human rights.
Resort. To deliver a talk about the digital.
Don't you do this while the contribution is playing? Reployable for the entry-level cubicle jobs of today, but
default computational aesthetic and interface.
They can operate effectively in the high-tech workplace. Exceptions, prejudices, and confusion. Outness as well. This may not be a big deal to high-tech. A single question most powerful people see themselves as you is we are sending and receiving. Our senses, and our